Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Citigroup announces 50,000 layoffs. Detroit's Big Three beg for help, and what started as a U.S. mortgage crisis has rolled into a worldwide financial meltdown. Financial historian Neil Ferguson, who warned of problems early on, now sees significant tough times ahead. This hour on Point, Neil Ferguson, on history's march through finance and where we stand today. You can join the conversation, big picture, what do you see going on in this economic crisis? Big hiccup, end of an era, passing of the crown of superpower. Joining me now in the studio is Neil Ferguson, professor of history at Harvard University, professor at Harvard Business School, senior research fellow at Oxford University. He's a widely published commentator and best-selling author who has emerged as a major global interpreter of our place in history. His books include Empire, Colossus, and The War of the World. His latest is The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. Neil Ferguson, thanks very much for being here.
Nice to be on the show, Tom.
What the heck are we in here? Depression, recession, something else? What is it?
It's certainly a big recession that we're heading into, bigger, I think, than most of your listeners have experienced. It may be that we're close to the nightmare scenario of Great Depression 2.0. I've been calling it the Great Repression. Repression as opposed to depression, because we had the potential for a Great Depression over a year ago when it became clear that the U.S. banking system was teetering on the brink of collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was a kind of inverse version of what happened in the Great Depression. The Fed poured liquidity into the financial system, the opposite of what it did in the Depression, and tried to repress the financial panic, tried to stop the banking system from imploding, and I think succeeded in large measure in therefore avoiding the worst-case scenario. But we're not out of the woods yet. There's a lot that can still go wrong.
You had a piece on the cover of Time magazine very recently, and the headline was, "No, this isn't Depression 2.0. I hear you saying now, just weeks later, well, maybe, still might be.
Isn't in the sense that the monetary authorities and the fiscal authorities are doing the right things, whereas they did exactly the wrong things last time around. In 29 to 33, the central bank actually raised rates at critical moments. And of course, there was an attempt to run a budget surplus rather than running a large deficit and having a stimulus package. So it's not the Great Depression in one critical sense. We have learnt some lessons from the past and we're not repeating those mistakes. But the problem is the Depression happened as a sequence of crises.
Mm-hmm.
It began in some ways as a banking crisis.
Mm-hmm.
It then became a global crisis and it intensified because governments did things that made matters worse, pursuing beggar-my-neighbor policies. What worries me at the moment is that we're not really seeing, despite the G20 summit at the weekend in Washington, real international coordination of either monetary policy or fiscal stimulus. And I think there's a danger that this thing could become a depression as a result of poor international coordination and a breakdown of that globally integrated economy we've been reaping the benefits of for so many years.
But let's say the world pulls together and does this thing. I mean, you're the historian, isn't it still the verdict of history has been that if only they had poured more cash into the economy, they could have averted the depression. But we're doing a real-time experiment in that right now, aren't we? I mean, we don't know for sure, or do we, that enough cash, an ocean of, I don't know, you know, liquidity poured out there would necessarily staunch this?
Well, what we can say, I think, is that you can prevent 25% unemployment and a 30% contraction in gross domestic product by
depression
measures
era levels,
like these,
great depression.
Those are the sorts of numbers that the United States suffered in the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't unique. Germany had an equally disastrous experience. I think we're not going to go there. I'd be very, very surprised indeed if we did. But this could be a pretty big recession, even with all the efforts that are being made. I think Treasury Secretary Henry Hank Paulson made the point only this morning that this was never going to be a miracle cure. This was a way of avoiding a depression, avoiding a meltdown, but you weren't going to sort of leap back into rapid growth after the old sort of one-quarter, two-quarter recessions that we've seen in recent decades. I think everybody has to get used to the idea that this is something more profound. I've been calling it the end of the age of leverage.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a couple of decades decades, really, in which not only government, but also households and especially banks have been able to pile on the debt. And we've juiced economic growth and we've juiced returns that way. But that game is up because we reached a kind of maximum. I think it was about 350% of gross domestic product. The debt level reached about there in 2007. And at that point, there was a kind of revolt, a global revolt, I think, in some measure, but also a revolt in the sense that it was no longer possible to believe that real estate prices would continue to grow at 10% or more
and
a year.
And undergird all that.
Exactly. And since a great edifice, a sort of inverted pyramid of financial instruments had been built on top of American real estate, the gradual realization that that kind of inflation in asset prices, inflation in land and housing prices wasn't sustainable, led to a classic financial panic of the sort that we've seen throughout history, when suddenly the euphoria switches into panic. And in the sense that the ascent of money is about this recurrent phenomenon historically, the fact that there are these bubbles and busts throughout history, I think it sheds some light on our present predicament. So far, it's not Great Depression 2.0. But I don't think it's completely inconceivable that we could still get there if we make policy mistakes, particularly at the international level.
Since you're saying that, it makes me want to stick the fork in. I mean, you warned of this early on, and pretty rightly. No one's talking about a glittering short-term future. Absolutely, there are going to be tough times. But you're now still saying it could go to tough times or terrible times, your nightmare scenario. Describe each of those for us. What is likely, what do you see as most likely at this point in terms of tough times? And if it should tip on into your nightmare scenario, Depression 2.0, what might that look like?
So the most probable scenario at the moment is that we get at least two quarters and maybe a whole year of negative growth. I mean, I bet that there would be a year's decline in output with a rather overconfident hedge fund manager in early 2007. He wanted to bet there would never be another U.S. recession, which gives you an idea of how unreasonable people had become in the upswing. So I wouldn't be surprised if 2009 was just a minus year, a big fat minus. And then I think
with unemployment like what?
With unemployment above 10%, but not much above it, would be my guess.
But 10% is pretty painful given where we've been. That's double where we've been.
That's right. So this is ugly and this is protracted. Then I think, in addition, I would say, looking over another 5 years, we would be getting much lower growth than we've been accustomed to. So perhaps annual rates south of 2%. So a significant reduction in the pace at which the U.S. economy grows.
What does that mean in terms of lifestyle, in terms of how it hits a family?
Well, it means, for example, and this is why the end of the age of leverage is a useful concept, that the ways in which we have previously enhanced our lifestyles, whether by using our houses as ATMs with mortgage equity withdrawal, or simply by using our credit cards, those sorts of techniques of improving, as it were, our lifestyle and beefing up our
juicing it.
These techniques are really going to go into abeyance. It's going to be much harder to get consumer credit of any sort. And income growth is not going to be very rapid. It's not been that rapid, actually, for most people over the last decade, and it may even be completely flat. In some sectors of the economy, it's likely to be negative. A big problem, which is very hard to speculate about, is whether or not we avoid deflation. If we actually end up with prices falling over a prolonged period...
And we just heard in the news, wholesale prices down. Of course, oil is way down, which is the major part of it.
There's a lot of volatility in energy and commodity markets, and the wholesale prices are very volatile. If consumer price inflation starts to be consistently negative for a period of time, then the whole process of deleveraging gets much harder because the real debt burdens that households are carrying start to grow in relation to the purchasing power of money. So I think that's a kind of a real worry that must make Ben Bernanke wake up in the night in a cold sweat.
So there's a reasonable worry and maybe a likely path, a down year and maybe 5 years of going nowhere.
Right.
What about the nightmare scenario? If it should tip, and I still hear the fear in your voice that it could.
Oh, yes. I think one should always have a worst-case scenario in mind. That's the way to think about the future. After all, there's no such thing as the future singular. There are futures. So here's a lower probability but not wholly incredible future. In that situation that I have in mind, there's a breakdown of the international financial system. It, in many ways, has relied on the readiness of creditor countries, Asian exporters, mm-hmm. energy exporters, to finance a very large American current account deficit, mm-hmm. equivalent to around 1% of gross domestic product. Now, we're kind of confidently assuming, at the moment, that they will continue to finance deficits of roughly that magnitude.
That is a deficit in our balance of trade, essentially.
Right. Mm-hmm. And most of the deficit next year is going to be accounted for by an enormous expansion in the federal government deficit, mm-hmm. which could be more than $1.5 trillion if all these various bailouts and right. stimulus packages go through. Now, what if, and I don't think this is a remote possibility, the Chinese and others say, wait a second, exports aren't going anywhere in these developed countries. We should focus on our own growth. Mm-hmm. And instead of putting resources into managing our exchange rate and buying all these 10-year treasuries and other American securities
from the US.
That
mm-hmm.
we've been accumulating over the past decade or so, let's divert our resources into building more bridges on the Yangtze and more highways to Chongqing mm-hmm. and make sure that there are jobs for our people. Now, if that's the case, then we could get a lot of volatility in the international bond market. The U.S. could suddenly be looking at much higher borrowing costs mm-hmm. when it goes to market. But we could also see a lot of volatility in currency markets. I mean, we confidently assume that the dollar will be the international mm-hmm. reserve currency mm-hmm. for forever and a day, rather the way the British did 100 years ago.
The pound, sterling.
But these
mm-hmm.
things come to an end. If countries get too indebted and their growth is too slow, the appeal of their currency wanes. And so a nightmare scenario would see a real dollar sell-off. And this would create all kinds of problems, particularly if it ran out of control, not just for the U.S. In some ways, it would help U.S. exporters, though it would make imports more expensive. Mm-hmm. But it would cause disruption to the rest of the world. And in the Depression, what really compounded the problem of the initial shock to the U.S. banking system was the breakdown of international trade and the breakdown of international capital flows. That could happen again, and I don't think we're worried enough about it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with financial historian Neil Ferguson about the economic mess we're in and what history tells us about where it may take us. His new book is The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. There's a sweeping title for you. Let's take a call from Rita in Buffalo, New York. Rita, you're on the air with Neil Ferguson.
Hi, Tom. Hi,
Hi
Neil. I'm listening to the show. I'm really enjoying it. And, you know, I've heard about the borrowers getting in over their heads with mortgages and, you know, people, you know, buying bonds that weren't any good, et cetera. But the brokers and the banks sold those things. They should have known what they were selling. And the insurance executives, you know, sold those credit default swaps. And I guess they didn't do a worst-case scenario mm. in terms of the bonds, you know, collapsing or the assets collapsing. How can we restore trust? I mean, why should I, as a person who's been saving her money and putting it in the 401k, buying mutual funds, etc., why should I trust any of those people again? They didn't look out for their own companies, let alone me. And I'm thinking, should we even have something like a Truth and Reconciliation Board where these guys and gals mm-hmm. come forward and say, you know, we're really sorry, but we were foolish, and here's some money back? I mean, I have no trust. I'm ready to put the money in just plain old CDs or,
right.
you know, I mean, where can I get my trust back?
Really, you're thinking big and you're thinking deep, and I think millions of people have exactly the same thought. Neil, how about it? Both in terms of how to get trust back now, and what does history tell us? When trust takes a hit, you know, you look across centuries in this book, when it takes a hit, traditionally, what does it take in terms of action or time to restore it?
Well, Rita, you're asking absolutely the right question. One of the things I point out in The Ascent of Money is that trust is the foundation of the financial system, that money itself is essentially based on trust, that in ancient Mesopotamia 4,000 years ago, creditors and debtors could only deal with one another using those extraordinary clay tablets that they used to use for financial transactions.
And that's really where money began, you're
that's
right.
That's the origins of, mm-hmm. of our financial
Iraq,
system.
Mesopotamia.
Right, in ancient Mesopotamia. Mm-hmm. Now, when trust disappears in the banking system, remember that most money today is bank money. It really consists of accounts at banks that we draw on, confidently assuming that the money will be there. If we lose our trust in banks, then something very, very profoundly goes wrong in the system. And we've seen a very interesting phenomenon in this crisis. It wasn't so much depositors losing trust in banks, though that did happen in some cases. In Britain, Northern Rock was a particularly egregious example of mm-hmm. a bank that suddenly lost the trust of its depositors. hazardous.
We saw the lines outside.
The lines outside banks, which hadn't been seen in London since 1866. Mm-hmm. Well, the real problem was that the trust between banks broke down, and it still hasn't really recovered. One of the things that really hasn't changed, despite the best efforts of the Fed, has been that banks still are very reluctant to lend one another significant sums of money for significant periods of time.
And so the credit crunch goes on.
The credit crunch goes on, measured by any of the obvious interest rates out there. And so it's not just your trust, Rita, that needs to be restored. It's the bank's trust in one another. And as long as that's absent, there is going to be a fundamental freeze in the way that the credit system
works. But what
works.
Brings that back historically? Is it just time until people forget when they were stung? Or is it are there steps that history shows us might be taken that signal effectively to the population, it's okay, it's going to be fine?
I think the most important thing is that we should come clean about the magnitude of losses. The problem is that we can calculate the losses on so-called toxic assets at the moment, and the Bank of England's latest estimate was north of $2 trillion. Mm-hmm. The trouble is that the actual write-downs admitted by the international banking system are more like a quarter of that sum. So there's a lot of loss still hiding out there, and the balance sheets of banks remain in some measure enigmatic things, with a great many assets that nobody can actually price at all.
But if they declare them in black and white, does that panic us right over the cliff?
Well, that's the big dilemma.
The stock market goes to 2 cents?
The dilemma is that you suddenly admit that a great many banks are in fact insolvent, and no amount of liquidity from the Fed is going to change that, because there is just an enormous and insuperable hole. So we are, in a sense, in a kind of limbo, and I don't really blame you, Rita, for lacking trust. Recapitalization is clearly the answer, but the truth may be that much more money is required to recapitalize the Western banking system than anybody yet wants to admit, unless, and this is the way out of the problem, you can generate some kind of recovery in the economy as a whole that starts to re-establish liquidity in the markets. At the moment, the problem is a lot of assets just don't have a price tag. Nobody can price them because there's no market for them. If you market to market, as you're supposed to, the price may be zero. And so we're dithering around trying to get around this problem, and it's not terribly easy to do with these relatively frozen markets. I think one of the critical issues that your question raises, though, Rita, is who's to blame? And I sometimes say the models are to blame. No, not the supermodels, but the models that they used when they were trying to attach prices to collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps. These models essentially assumed that the probability of a huge financial crisis like this was very, very, very low indeed. But history, financial history, would have told them that, in fact, the probability of something like this happening is pretty high, because crises like this happen, well, roughly once a century.
And we're not immune.
And we had not done anything to get ourselves into a place where we could confidently say, this time it's different, it won't happen to us. So winning trust back is the key, but it's extremely hard to do with so much, as it were, unacknowledged loss out there. And the danger is, as I think you just rightly said, Tom, that if we fess up right now, at this moment, we might as well admit that a whole bunch of other banks are insolvent, and nobody wants to do that. So we're in limbo. It's
sober-minded people trying to ride through it. Rita wants maybe a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and that's some idea.
I think
itself.
We're more likely, Rita, to get a really ugly congressional inquiry over the next months, which will increase the number of scapegoats and people to bear the blame, and may even end up with some people going to jail. But of course, it won't restore trust. That's the problem. Well, pointing the finger won't necessarily restore trust.
That's, on the other hand, kind of the American way of truth and reconciliation. I mean, Congress has played a role. Let's go to Paul in Easton, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for many great shows.
You're so welcome.
This one.
You're so welcome. What are you thinking, Paul?
And I have a question for Dr. Ferguson. Typically, your entrepreneurs tend to be a little bit over-optimistic. That's what drives them. And sometimes economists are a little more pessimistic, but certainly we have done a lot of wrong things to get ourselves in a mess this time. And hopefully, if they figure out what to regulate, they can put in some more regulations, as they have done periodically in the past, and that will help restore trust. But the world does have something going for it, however, in the future, which makes me a little bit more optimistic, namely the growth in China, India, Brazil, and some other countries. I think in the future that these countries may be trading more with each other. For example, India has a very large middle class, and as well as with Europe and the United States and Japan. And I think that could be a growth engine for the world in the future.
Paul, it's a great question, and let us pick it straight up. Neil Ferguson, I think many people have been kind of stunned so far that for all we've heard and talked about China, India, et cetera, when we ran out of gas, they didn't appear to have another gas tank. I mean, what about Paul's question? Can they not generate the growth to be the engine that pulls the world? You said China earlier. Maybe it would pull in its horns and focus entirely domestically. But could it not do both that and be this recapitalization source for the rest of the world? It's got so much capital up its sleeve. Could it do both? Might it not be in its interest to do both?
Well, of course, there was a theory that China would decouple from the United States and would somehow be able to walk away from this kind of financial crisis without its growth rate being significantly impaired. That theory looks a lot less compelling right now, Paul, because apart from anything else, China's stock market is down more than 60%.
Thousands of factories closed.
The export sector turned out to still matter, and it's taking an absolutely huge hit. And the Chinese authorities are really worried as they see the growth rate slip down to 7%, perhaps even lower. That sounds like a great growth rate to us. Mm. But of course, for China, with its huge underemployed rural workforce, it's just not fast enough to absorb all those surplus workers. Mm-hmm. In relative terms, Chinese economy, and indeed the economy of Brazil, plus Russia, plus India and China as well, they can't compensate for a recession that happens simultaneously in the United States, the European Union and Japan, because that is something like 2/3 of global GDP. If that contracts, then it's going to take an enormous explosion of growth in the emerging markets to compensate for it. Now, I agree with one thing you said, Paul, and that is that entrepreneurs have a kind of crucial role to play in all of this. And I don't want to give the impression to you or other listeners that I'm absolutely deeply pessimistic. On the contrary, I remind myself that even in the trough of the Depression, the United States continued to be a center of innovation, both technological innovation and innovation in management. Mm. In the 1970s, which was the last really grim decade mm-hmm. in American economic history, the decade of stagflation, companies like Microsoft and Apple were founded. And my hope is that necessity will be the mother of invention, and that in the United States, despite the financial meltdown, our energies will be diverted away from, selling collateralized debt obligations mm-hmm. and CDOs and all the rest of it into the kind of innovation that is ultimately more productivity enhancing over the long run.
So there's maybe still the ace up the American sleeve.
Yes, I think that ace is
new
still there.
New technology, new economic value along with that.
It's not clear that the Chinese, for all their rapid growth, have yet actually got beyond replicating inventions that we've essentially come up with. And that's a critical point to bear in mind. The Silicon Valleys and their equivalents on the East Coast are absolutely the key to the American future. And as long as innovation goes on in those areas, and it can go on even in a depression, then all is by no means not lost.
But stick with China for a second. Put yourself, in Paul's question, put yourself in the Forbidden City at the top of the communist, the country ruling hierarchy there. And they're weighing, they've got this huge mountain of reserves that they've accumulated largely through trade with the U.S. and others. They're now looking at their options here. Well, we could swing in and try and rescue the United States, not just because we love Americans, but because their market is important to us. Or we could use this to pump up our own economy internally. We could do both. Each has a kind of a different outcome. One might shift more power to China than another ultimately. Yeah. How do you think they're looking at their options and the consequences?
Well, I was just out in Singapore last week and talking to quite a lot of Chinese economists from Hong Kong and also from the mainland. And the impression I got is that they see themselves confronted by a dilemma. On the one side, they still need that export sector. It hasn't stopped being an engine of growth. They do not want to be, as it were, on the wrong side of a drastic contraction in American imports. And therefore, they don't want to see the dollar fall through the floor and their own currency appreciate and the entire export sector wiped out. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they're quite tempted by the idea that they could channel their resources into expanding domestic consumption and betting, so to speak, on the Chinese consumer. As that Chinese middle class grows, there is a greater demand for Chinese products in China itself. The dilemma is what to do with the resources. Do you take your $500 billion plus of stimulus package and essentially carry on in the old way, using the resources to finance the U.S. current account deficit, to mm-hmm. increase your reserves still further, mm-hmm. but to maintain a relative peg between your currency and the dollar and keep those exports going, even if there is a somewhat depressed market? market for them? Or do you take the same resources and you say, forget about the exports, that game is over because those guys are in recession. Let's go and expand consumption in China itself. And my sense from my trip to Asia is that the second option looks more attractive the worse things get in the developed world.
Wow.
And that's kind of nerve-wracking for us because it means that there could be one of the key engines of growth, China, simply taking its own rather self-interested path. Call it market socialism in one country.
Mm.
That, of course, is a version of what Russia did in the 1930s, which was to opt out of the Great Depression and do it absolutely in an autarkic way, focusing on Russian growth.
Which would leave the U.S. on the outside looking in, at least at all those Chinese reserves. Let's get a call from Redwood, New York, and Charles. Hi, Charles. You're on the air with Neil Ferguson.
Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ferguson, my question is really about inflation. Is it possible that at some point the United States will external and its local debt?
Charles is breaking up on us, but I see his question here is, at some point, could the United States decide to whittle that debt down through unleashing massive inflation, use inflation to kind of devalue the debt to make it manageable?
Well, of course, this is the option that you can exercise if you're one of those lucky countries that can borrow in its own currency. And the more of the rest of the world that that stacks up claims on you denominated in dollars, the more easily you can reduce the real value of those claims by depreciating your currency. It sounds like an easy fix. I'm not sure how easy it is in practice to do, though.
You mean to actually gin up the inflation?
Right. I mean, part of the problem is that in a recession of this magnitude, the pressure is all in the other direction, towards deflation. Prices are falling. Fuel prices are falling. Housing is falling in price. Almost all commodities are heading south. Under those conditions, a central bank could have to work very hard indeed. And indeed, it might reach the limit of its resources. After all, we're not that far from the zero interest rate policy. In effect, the effective federal funds rate is very close to 0% already.
Once Japan did that and went nowhere.
Right, so you have the Japan scenario, which we probably should have talked about before, because in a sense, when I said we were looking at 5 years of pretty flat growth, what I had in mind was a version of the Japanese lost decade.
I was there in the 80s when the streets were full of gold and Ferraris, and then boom.
Yeah, and then boom. And of course, it should be said that the Chinese have a nightmare that it'll happen to them too if they're not careful. But I think this notion that we're all turning Japanese in the developed world, that the excesses of real estate speculation and of bank leverage are driving us towards a period of really miserably low growth, whatever we do, whatever the central banks do, however much we borrow, however big the stimulus package is, we're just going to be bumping along like the Japanese did. Now, I don't think we've made quite as many mistakes as they did, because it took them a very long time indeed to admit just how bad the problems were within their banking system. Mm-hmm. And we, I think, are trying to do this early, even if it does hurt. So that's why I have a sense it's more like 5 lost years than 10 lost years. But that Japanese scenario, it makes it quite hard to imagine the inflationary exit, Charles, that you're talking about. Yes, we're going to see enormous monetary expansion, at least in the monetary base. So the Fed has increased its balance sheet in the most incredible way. It's more than doubled in size as a result of all kinds of liquidity injections and auction facilities. But when you look at broad money, when you look at the money supply, including bank deposits, it's not growing at all. In fact, it's beginning to shrink. And that's, I think, at the heart of the problem. The Fed is, to use an old phrase of economics, pushing on a string. It's cutting rates. It's trying to get the banking system going again. But the banks are just sitting there feeling so sick with extraordinarily high levels of leverage and balance sheets from hell that they're not making new loans. So you have, it seems to me, under those conditions, very little chance of a kind of leap back to 1970s-style inflation. That, at the moment, is a very low-probability scenario.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with financial historian Neil Ferguson about the economic mess we're in and what history tells us about where it may take us. He's professor of history at Harvard, also at Harvard Business School, senior research fellow at Jesus College at Oxford University, also at the Hoover Institution in Stanford, California. You can read him all over the place, the Time Magazine, Financial Times, all kinds of big books out there on the past and future of the world. His latest is The Ascent of Money, a financial history of the world. Let's take a call from Michigan. Michigan very much in the news and on people's minds these days. Diane is on the line from Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Diane. You're on the air with Neil Ferguson.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
My personal situation is I'm an amateur mathematician, and I discovered a new algebra, the orientation congruent algebra. It has applications to differential geometry.
Good.
I'm trying to get recognized academically, but I'm in a low-paying job. I may lose my job. I may end up being homeless. This will have an impact on the cultural output of the human race
mm-hmm.
through artistic and more esoteric fields like pure mathematics rather than the innovation and technology-oriented research. That
so, but we're supposed to need the kind of innovation you're doing if you've got a new mathematical formula. What's your question, Diane?
Well, isn't this going to compound the misery? Do we need maybe a WPA project for people in this kind of work line as well? Or how can we mitigate the effects on the cultural output, including pure mathematics, art, more esoteric physics?
Diane, let me take that and broaden it, if I may. Neil, you call innovation still an ace up the American sleeve. Mm. Are we positioned to maximize our use of it? Right on Diane's notepad, where she's got a new formula, you know, right on through, education-wise and the rest. If that's our saving grace, are we positioned to make the most of it?
One of the great advantages the United States enjoys is that it has still the best universities in the world. And these universities are very important centers of innovation, and they're also quite important economic stabilizers. It's at times like this that suddenly the class of 2009 decides it wants to do graduate work rather than to go to Goldman Sachs. I've been noticing that quite a lot in the last few months. And
maybe to be engineers rather than quants.
Because we've had a big distortion in the job market for graduates. They have been siphoning off people in all fields, particularly in the more quantitative fields, and sending them off to financial services. And there is a question mark over just how far that was in the long-term interests of the country. So perhaps what we're going to see is that mathematicians like you, Diane, will be rather better deployed. Now, of course, your predicament strikes me as an unusual one. If you're a talented mathematician who's stuck in a low-paid and insecure
mm-hmm.
job,
Eddie.
You need somehow to get yourself back into the great American educational system. Because in some ways that has become the key to this country's success. The paradox is, of course, that there's a tremendous weakness in the educational system at the secondary level. Great universities, mm. but actually not great schools for people in the age group below university mm. age, which is why what the U.S. increasingly does is to import talent into the university system from abroad. And many of the innovators that will produce the next Googles as well as the next Microsofts won't probably be U.S. born. They'll come here and study here, having got their secondary education elsewhere.
Let's stick with Michigan and Detroit for a minute. Detroit, the big three in Washington, begging for a very big handout. A, should the U.S. give them that? What do you think through the prism of history? And B, you've said, as bad as things have been in Detroit lately, you know, really, neighborhoods really in economic stress, you've said we may see more Detroits around this country. Silicon Valley is the shining city on the hill end of the spectrum, but you're fearing more sort of browned out, rusted out, yeah. ground down cities.
One of the great problems about economic history is what Joseph Schumpeter called the problem of creative destruction. I talk in The Ascent of Money about the evolutionary character of financial history, and mm-hmm. it's true more generally that the process of innovation is rather like the process of mutation in the natural world.
You bow to Charles Darwin when you talk about it.
Yes, I'm a little nervous about invoking Darwin because, in fact, it's more like Lamarck, his French predecessor, mm-hmm. who thought that innovation in the natural world was conscious. And we are conscious in the way that we innovate in the realm of mm-hmm. economics and finance. We try to make things better, and we experiment with a view to becoming more efficient, but it doesn't always work. And indeed, what happens is like natural selection. The things that don't work die. And they tend to die in rather large numbers when the climate turns nasty, as it has in economic terms, mm-hmm. in the last 14 or 15 months. The dilemma is that in this world of financial evolution, there is such a thing as intelligent design. It's called regulators and legislators. And they can intervene in the way that no deity could intervene to keep the dinosaurs alive, to keep some economic dinosaurs alive, if it seems expedient. The problem is this: if you keep all the dinosaurs alive, if everybody's entitled to a bailout who gets
gets into trouble, because if they don't get bailed out, people will lose their jobs, you begin to lose all the benefits of natural selection. The survival of the fittest stops operating, and it's the survival of the fattest. And the lumbering dinosaurs carry on lumbering, and gradually your economy stagnates and stops being innovative. I speak with the experience of somebody who grew up in Britain. Back in the 1970s, we had an automobile industry in Britain that was propped up with endless amounts of taxpayers' money, got no more productive as a result, and died a long, lingering, and very expensive death. I worry a little bit that the very first decision President-elect Obama is going to make will be to go down that European route of channeling public resources into inefficient companies that really do not necessarily deserve to be given an extension of their lives. There are efficient car producers in the United States. It just so happens that they're not based in Detroit and they're not American-owned.
But this image of more Detroits around the country.
Well, I think there's no question that
That's tough to take in itself.
Right. In a recession, a whole bunch of economic sectors, and not just the automobile industry, will take a big hit. And some cities, particularly those which are heavily reliant on a particular manufacturing sector, or even on an express delivery service company, will lose jobs. And with the loss of jobs, they will lose prosperity. It's not pretty. I mean, nobody can pretend this is going to be fun. The question is, does the government have the power to arrest this process simply by writing checks at the expense either of present or future taxpayers? The trouble I have at the moment is that we have a bailout plan, $700 billion or so earmarked to bail out, probably more to come. But the question is, what is this bailout for? What is this money for? And we're losing sight of the original idea, which was to try to prevent the banking system from breaking down. Nobody should pretend the banking system is fixed. As we said earlier, there's a whole lot of red ink still out
but
there.
But they're still wanting to pour money in. It's just not to the toxic debt, but rather right into the banks, to the equity.
Which I think is the right way to go, and always was. I must say, I have to ask myself why a year ago this wasn't being discussed, because it was obvious that the banks needed recapitalizing a year ago.
Maybe it was too shameful for Hank Paulson. He came from that world. It was almost shaming for him to admit the banks needed it.
Do you know, Tom, I actually agree with that. I think there was a basic problem of imagination at the Treasury under Paulson.
Remember, his first response was, we will never go there. Right. That's a sign of failure. And he couldn't admit that the world he came from had failed.
But people were still in denial. I called it the Wile E. Coyote effect. You remember how Coyote used to run off the cliff after Roadrunner, and it took him a couple of seconds to realize he was off the cliff and look down. Well, it took actually 12 months for Hank Paulson to look down and realize that actually the investment banks had run off a cliff and were about to head to the bottom of the gorge.
As bad as things are here, you've said they're worse in Europe. Yeah. Why?
Well, this is something that isn't at all recognized here, and I'm not sure it's recognized in Europe either, because Europeans love to point the finger of blame at the United States and say, look, what a failure for the American model of the unregulated market. Well, the joke is on them, because if you look at the European banks, particularly in countries like Britain, in Germany, interestingly, the banks are more leveraged, and the liabilities, particularly the short-term liabilities, are much larger in relation to GDP than is the case here.
Even though they're more heavily regulated?
Oh, despite the regulation.
Argument then that regulation is a mirage, that it's not the fix?
I think all this talk of regulation is really very, very beside the point. That there is a naive view that this crisis can be blamed on deregulation, and if only we had had regulation, there would never have been a problem. And I like to remind people, once again, using financial history, think back to the 1970s when all those regulations were in place. Was that a wonderful crisis-free time in the financial system? Actually, no. I mean, there was a secondary banking crisis in Britain and double-digit inflation in most of the developed world. It's not a matter of deregulation versus regulation. It's a matter of good regulation versus bad regulation, because markets always need to be regulated.
So Europe had bad regulation?
The regulation was no better. I mean, think of the most important thing of all, capital adequacy of banks. It was just as much the case in Europe as in America that banks became ever more leveraged. Deutsche Bank, in fact, was more of an offender than the major American banks in terms of allowing its assets and liabilities to explode in relation to its underlying
capital. Sarkozy has gone home from the G20 meeting in Washington and said, you know, we are going to teach the world, the Americans, how to live. I mean, is the European future brighter or darker than
it is? It's much darker, and this is hubris on the part of the Europeans, as well as political grandstanding, because, of course, what they don't have in Europe, though they do have a single currency for most of the EU members, is a single treasury. They don't have the equivalent of the US Treasury. So when the Europeans go about trying to bail out their banking systems, it's every man for himself. And so far, it really has been a mess. In Britain, which I would see as Greater Iceland in terms of the potential potential for the financial system to cause the whole economy to go down the tubes, there is a complete and willful failure to recognize how serious the problem is. And indeed, Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, has been posing almost as much as Nicolas Sarkozy as the great solver of the problem. I'm afraid it's going to get much worse for the Europeans, and they don't actually have the policy levers that we have here in the United States to deal with this problem. And I'm not recommending Schadenfreude. We shouldn't turn around and laugh at them when this happens, because it won't be good for us as the European Union suffers a really big recession.
I'm not laughing.
No, but it's worth remembering before we start having this argument about the American system being at fault, that the European system is just as much at fault.
Let's take a call from Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate this program. Something I've been puzzling over, trying to understand it. I'm a simple guy with simple tastes.
Okay,
me too, Sam. I'm very simple.
Well,
we're all
simple. To me, the first thing we can all agree on is this is a man-made catastrophe.
Yep.
This didn't happen in nature. People made this up. And I think they're winners and losers. I think the people who made a lot of money, they're winners. This isn't a catastrophe for them. And I think, you know, you're the historian. When you look back to 1929, it seems to me, in my limited understanding of this, there's a huge difference between 29 and 2008, which is that this is all about speculation. All this money was not being invested in corporations. This was all speculative money. That's the only way I can make sense of it. It's the same with gas prices. There's no way gas can be worth $4 4 months ago and worth $2 today. It's
well, the economies have crashed quite a lot, though, the prospect for using it. Put a question, Sam.
So the question is at the bottom, this just seems to be a real question of transparency. It seems to me a guy like Hank Paulson is just really taking care of his buddies. We gave $200 billion to all these banks. They were supposed to use that money to get liquidity going, and it turns out they're doing what you'd expect them to do, which is give the money to shareholders, to stock options, to bonuses. They're not using the money the way Congress told them to use it. And until we get some transparency, like the way FDR did the minute he got elected, he shut down the banks. He said, I'm sending my own accountants in there. We're going to crack these books open and see what the hell is going on.
Sam, let us pick it up right there. We've got it, and our clock is running down. I'm grateful for your call, Sam. Neil, Sam's put a mouthful on the table, but you see what he's getting at. The transparency wants to know what's really going on. Let me just flavor it with a quote from your book. The ascent of money, because I think it may feed into this. You say the fundamental truth about money that far from being a monster that must be put back in its place, as the German president recently complained, you say financial markets are like the mirror of mankind, revealing every hour of every working day the way we value ourselves and the resources of the world around us. I'm piggybacking a big idea on Sam, but I'm sure you can take them both on.
Well, I think, Sam, you're right to draw a parallel with 1929 and the subsequent policy shift under Roosevelt. There was speculation then, too, though. I mean, what drove up stock prices in the late 1920s was a whole range of financial innovations, like the creation of investment trusts, that essentially existed to speculate in the price of company stock. And it really was a bubble no different from the dot-com bubble of the 1990s and the real estate bubble that burst in 2007. And the point I try and make in The Ascent of Money is that this just does happen. It happens because we have a tendency to behave like a herd, to stampede towards the possibility of easy money. When the money is easy, when it's easy to borrow, and when it looks as if the assets are going to keep appreciating at a rate much higher than the interest rate we're paying on our loans, it's pretty hard for anybody to resist following the herd and the stampede. The stampede drives the price of the assets up to the point which finally becomes incredible. Then the mood shifts and we go via distress, revulsion to panic. This cycle has repeated itself throughout history. You can go right back to Dutch tulips or the French Mississippi Company in 1719. And I think the difficulty for us is to recognize that it's just inherent in the way that markets work. And it's probably impossible to regulate that phenomenon out of existence because, short that is, of creating a planned economy, because that's the way our human psychology works. Behavioral finance has been one of the most interesting fields in economics in recent recent years.
Animal spirits.
Animal spirits. When we recognize that we're not the homo economicus, the rational calculating machine of classic economic theory, but we actually are subjective and indeed often irrational in the way that we think about these problems. The other point to bear in mind is that the New Deal, although it was very, very good at creating government jobs, did not turn around the U.S. economy in a particularly dramatic fashion. The U.S. had another recession in 1937. Growth was pretty lousy, actually, until the ultimate stimulus package came along, World War II.
So shy of that, we've got a minute. What's your advice to Barack Obama?
I think he's got to be extremely careful not to lose focus, that there's a limit to how much public money can be used to stimulate this economy back into life. And if every single lobbyist of every single sector of the economy comes along asking for a piece of the action, the focus will be lost.
So focus on what?
I think the recapitalization of the banks remains the key. I think we have to make sure that the financial system gets going again, or we go down the Japanese route, if not the Great Depression route. So that would be point number one. Point number two is the international dimension that we talked about earlier, Tom. We can't pretend we can solve this problem on our own. This is one global economy. There is what I call Chimerica that links China and America together in a symbiotic way. And it's making sure that that relationship,
to be hoped for,
which I think is absolutely to be hoped for. And it's vital and I think absolutely crucial that President-elect Obama focuses on that relationship with China and doesn't get distracted by the much too unwieldy G20, which won't in any case meet again until April. So that would be point number two. First of all, get the banking system straightened out. We aren't anywhere near there yet. And then look to China and make sure that relationship doesn't break down.
Big times and big challenges, and nobody really throws his work around them more effectively. Neil Ferguson's new book is The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. Dr. Ferguson, thank you very much for being with us. It was great.
Thank you, Tom, but call me Neil next time.
Okay, Neil. You got it. Thanks for being here. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.